Welcome to Golau, where we shed some light on politics, policy and polling in Wales and the world. This episode of Golau follows the publication of Dr. Thomas Pross's book, What's in It for Me?, which discusses self-interest and tribalism in politics. Tom is joined here by former UK government minister, now member of the Lords, Baroness Nicky Morgan, and steering the conversation, Professor Glenn O'Hara of Oxford Brookes University takes the chair.
We're here to talk about Tom Pross's new book, What's in It for Me? And what Tom does in the book is he goes through each type of politics, asking, you know, are conservatives nasty? I don't think Nicky probably thinks they're not. Yeah, are they nasty? Are they inherently nasty? Probably not. Are they born that way? Are Brexiteers stupid? Are liberal values the values of wealthy people? And what are the values of the new left and social democrats? And what he's trying to do in that book, I think, is invite us in a very fractured age and a very divided age, as we've, let's face it, we've just seen in the US Capitol and in Washington, D.C., to say, well, actually, we can come together if we see others with their own views and their own interests more clearly. And in the light of that, how they see the world. It reminded me a bit of something we call the veil of ignorance in kind of welfare studies, which is, you know, if you imagine that's you, how would you see things? And if you imagined your starting point was different, was conservative, those of you who are liberal, and liberal, those of you who are conservative, how would you see the world and how would you react to someone, for instance, in a Brexiteer's view, patronising them as if they're stupid when they feel they voted for something perfectly legitimate? That's the book, which I think is really interesting. And in a time of, you know, figurative violence and lots of threats on social media, potentially very important. So without further ado, firstly, Tom, and then Nicky to talk about these themes. And then I think we'll just freewheelingly discuss. So, Tom, over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Glenn. It's really good to be here. I'll just say a few words about the book before we commence. So this is a book about self-interest. In recent years, politics has obviously become very heated and people have started to call each other stupid, traitor, and so on and so forth. And what I think that talking about self-interest does is it allows us to be more self-reflective and to see the humanity in our opponents. It ties in very much to my academic work. I've long been interested in institutional theory and what institutional theory is about is incentive structures. Why do people have incentives to do particular things, whether that's voters or firms or political parties? And that theory explains the functions and origins and evolution of relevant incentive structures. The idea of the book is really to apply that to contemporary political problems, and I hope that there's a bit of a new slant on current problems by applying that theoretical perspective. So that's the book in a nutshell.
In terms of tribalism, I think the book is really fascinating, and I think it's a good question to ask, and it's a good question to ask of all of ourselves, which is why we vote the way that we do, and particularly if you always vote the same way. And I'm sure we'll come on to discuss all of that. I joined my party, the Conservative Party, when I was 16 years old. My father was a local councillor, and I've been therefore involved in my party for over 30 years. And trying to explain to people who are not political why you would want to get involved in politics is always a hard thing. And probably the closest thing, analogy, is, you know, why do people carry on supporting football teams even when they have never won anything, or their last win of a major tournament was a long, long time ago? And I think that is quite a good analogy. It is a very tribal, instinctive thing, often, if you are particularly focused on a sports team. And I think Thomas's book is not, it's not a heavy, dusty academic tome. And I think that's a good thing. And I think a lot of people are very interested in politics, particularly after the last few years, without necessarily being involved in or interested in policies. But I guess what I can bring this evening that perhaps our other speakers can't is that frontline doorstep experience, particularly over the last couple of years, of trying to represent a constituency of 85,000 people, each of whom will have their views, and particularly on something like Brexit, will have very strong views often, or no view at all and really not care and can't understand what the fuss is about. So hopefully I will try to bring some practical, frontline political doorstep experience to the discussion.
I was going to actually pick up with Nikki about how divided up were your constituents, but I'm going to hold back on that one because I'll give you a moment to think of that diplomatically. But I wondered if I might pick up with Tom something that occurred to me, which is that the book is quite personal. The book is really where you're coming from as, I suppose, I don't want to give you away, but a kind of left of centre social democrat, rather like myself. So why did you write it, and where are you coming from?
You know, of course, academic writing is crucial. The theoretical insights you can gain from academic writing are extremely important. But it's also, if you want to communicate things to a general audience, a more sort of accessible style is necessary, I think. And as I say in the book, I'm personally a centre-left social democrat, and I argue for that point of view in the book, but hopefully do so without dismissing other worldviews outright.
Do you think it's really the social democrats that have got squeezed out, and are they on the way back? Because we've had the last 5 years of Corbynism versus Vote Leave, which to a certain extent has hampered people like Nikki as well, kind of more liberal Tories, if I want to put it like that. But are Starmer and Dodds going to be bringing that back to some extent? Do you feel happier now that your book can push with the grain? Because 2 or 3 years ago, you would have said this might plop into a kind of a sea of disputation. But there seems to me a bit more ambition and range around the kind of people you're trying to encourage with this book.
With social democracy, I think we've got to take a step back here, because in Britain, we think that social democratic politics is as natural as the sun coming up, because we've known it for 120 years or whatever. But the reality is that research actually shows that conservative cultural values correlate better or correlate with left-wing economic values. So the reality is that social democratic coalitions, they group industrial workers or poor people in post-industrial areas with public sector workers and richer social cultural professionals. And I'm not sure that it's that natural a coalition. You can look at it, you know, you could say it's a Western coincidence. There's a good argument for that. On the other hand, with Labour at the moment, it does appear that the party are making progress. It's related to the fact that culture is becoming less salient, related to the point about lower classes being culturally conservative. It's easier for the Conservative Party when culture is a salient issue, like in 2019 with Brexit. I think that at the moment, because of coronavirus, the politics of competence is most salient, which is very good news, I think, for Labour, because most would agree that the current Keir Starmer he seems to be more competent than the Prime Minister.
I'm thinking about big figures from the past in this mould, and the examples I would use would be Harold Wilson and Jim Callaghan, and they're kind of two Prime Ministers who unite what you're talking about, which is economically quite radical, but socially quite conservative, and therefore, in your frame, successful for Labour. But recent years, haven't they, have seen leaders who are either one or the other. So they don't have that unity anymore that can bring together what you're talking about, which is a lot of voters who are way left on this kind of traditional axis, but quite right wing. But in traditional terms, on social access, social issues like crime and punishment, like sexuality, like identity.
The problem for Labour as well is that the working class, the traditional working class, who would have had left-wing economic views, but culturally conservative views also have declined numerically. So maybe only 15-20% of the population today. In the 1960s, they might have been close to 50% or whatever. And such voters are certainly no longer a critical mass in the Labour Party. Probably the critical mass now are richer urban liberals who work in the public sector or social cultural professionals.
Yeah.
And I think that once those voters are a critical mass, left-wing parties across the West become more culturally liberal, and it's something that the traditional Labour voters aren't particularly keen on.
I wondered, Nikki, did you come across this more and more in your constituency? So traditionally, I live in a very divided constituency socially, and these days you'll now go to quite low income areas and find swathes of Conservative voters. And then you'll go to these streets with £2 million houses and they've all got Labour signs in them in the front garden. Was that your experience that things, the great passing each other happened just like in the US?
But to a certain extent, I mean, Loughborough is a very, very middle England. It's so in the Brexit referendum, it literally voted 50-50, which, you know, is you asked about representing. I mean, it's a real challenge when you've got people with very diametrically opposed views. I first stood in Loughborough in 2000 with the 2005 general election, and it was a Labour-held seat then. And obviously, in order to win it eventually in 2010, you have to switch a certain number of people from voting for Blair Brown to voting for, you know, Cameron, or at least being open enough. Or, of course, don't forget in politics, there's a number of people who decide to sit out elections, and that in its own way is about making a point. So when I stood in 2005, it was just after the Iraq War, and actually a lot of the traditional Bangladeshi vote that the Labour Party had relied on previously just sat out the election. They didn't vote for me, but they didn't vote for the Labour Party either. And likewise, I think in the course of when the Conservative Party was in opposition, a number of Conservative voters didn't switch to voting for Blair or Brown. They just didn't vote at all. They just sat out those elections. So we should never forget the people that choose not to engage, because I think they're sending a message too. But it is right to say that when my successor won the seat in 2019, she definitely attracted, because of the whole Brexit thing, she attracted support, I would have said, from a different group of voters than the coalition of voters that I'd put together in 2005, but then 2010 and 2015 and 2017. It has begun to switch by 2017, but it really accelerated by 2019.
I wonder if this now, Tom, as well, I wonder if this now poses challenges, is going to pose challenges for Conservatives. If we accelerate this ahead, what we're going to see is probably like the United States. The more suburban, the more educated, the more college educated we get, strangely different to our previous experience, those areas are going to go redder and redder, just as they've been going for Biden with huge swings. So, Tom, are the Conservatives going to find it really hard to hold on to, for instance, Guildford or Walton and Esher, these seats where people look like, you know, people like me live in them?
Yeah, I'm sitting in the Cardiff North constituency, actually, which was won by the Conservatives in 2015, but then went Labour in 2017, and it was held with an increased majority in 2019. So really bucking the national trend, and it's because it's a fairly affluent constituency with lots of social cultural professionals in it. I think the problem, however, is you ask where are the swing voters, who are the median voters, and the median voters are in the red wall seats, and obviously they're more culturally conservative, so that I would say is a more relevant thing, you know, the piling of votes in Cardiff North or the London or Liverpool constituencies doesn't really matter in a way, but because obviously we have an electoral system in the UK that's not proportional.
But in the medium term, in 10 years or 15 years, it might matter quite a lot if London continues to shed sociocultural professionals across southern England and towards, you know, in towards the Midlands with faster rail links. And also, even if there are only 2,000 or 3,000 Liberal Democrat voters in those seats, if Starmer detaches 1,000, 1,500 of those voters who couldn't tolerate Corbyn and Brexit, that's still progress for Labour. It's just not, what you're saying is not quick enough to get to power anytime soon, I suppose.
Yeah, of course. It is progress. Of course, it's progress for Labour, and you know it's difficult to say what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years' time. A point that's often missed in the media, I think, it's the value of applying academic theories to politics is actually in a country like Britain, which is a majoritarian political system, and liberal economy, you should expect conservative dominance. There's a very influential theory by political economists, Iverson and Soskith, which basically demonstrates that the way that societal institutions and the economy and the political system are set up in Britain encourages domination of the right. In the UK, I think how many years has the Labour Party been in power over the last 100 years? And it's a very well respected theory. So that's always the background I think you have to bear in mind when you talk about the prospects of Labour. That's life. But yes, of course, you can't be too deterministic about things. And of course, different issues are now becoming salient. It was cultured, maybe competent, and there's no reason whatsoever why Starmer can't win in 5 years.
Is that your view as well, Nikki, that Labour does have opportunities to break through on cultural issues as well? Because we've changed how Thatcher and Major could have used wedge issues in the 1980s and 1990s. British people have now become enormously and rapidly liberal about. The Conservatives have to keep finding, it seems to me, cultural issues like Europe to keep wedging.
Yeah, I mean, I think Europe's probably not the right. I can see what you say about it being a cultural issue, but it was also it was a political, I said, ideological issue for a small number of Conservatives for quite a long time, who pushed it for 30 years or more, and then it obviously broke it more into the mainstream. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I think one of the strengths of the Conservative Party, and the reason why Tom is right, I think if you do an analysis of the last 70 years or something, why the Conservatives have been in power more than Labour, is the Conservative Party is able to maintain a broad framework, but it absolutely does, if you like, move with the times. And you'll find, you know, things have moved, you know, gay marriage being one of them, for example, you know, David Cameron, you know, out of tune with many in his party. You know, I didn't vote for it first time, but then actually makes the case, and you sit here, listen to what the public are saying, and you think, yeah, actually we should be doing this. And so, you know, actually you change. And that's the Conservative Party is very good at adapting like that, whilst up till now has been very much about preserving key institutions in this country. And I think that appeals to many people. I think just the fact that Keir Starmer is not Jeremy Corbyn gives him an immediate advantage with most of the country, other than the Corbyn supporting groups, of which I don't think there are that many, although it's clearly still a huge issue for colleagues within the Labour Party, who are very mindful every time they give a media interview, they will come off air and they'll say, I know I'm just going to get absolute levels of abuse and grief about that. So I think within the party there's still a huge battle to be won. And when you've got a divided party, of course, the machinery is divided too. You know, you can tell when you're in a political party that's doing well, going to win. And everybody in the party is pulling in the same direction. I suspect it was like that for the Democrats this year. Even those who weren't particular Joe Biden fans, you know, look at Bernie Sanders, for example. You know, Joe Biden isn't particularly his cup of tea, but they were so focused, rightly, on getting Trump out of the White House, they're prepared to put all that to one side and work together. I think the other thing I hope we'll get a chance to explore, of course, don't forget that, and I was listening to something today about Trump and the Republican Party, don't forget often party members are quite different from the people that we see in Westminster. So party members, as we know, the Conservative Party tended to be much more pro-Brexit, pro-leaving and everything else than the Conservative Parliamentary Party in Westminster. That has now shifted as a result of the new intake of MPs that came in for the Conservative Party in 2019.
But you did you not experience then the same level of abuse and division as your Labour colleagues? I mean, the kind of treatment meted out to Luciana Berger, for instance,
yeah. It was very absolutely different. Appalling. Because it didn't come so much from within. I mean, look, there was a certain amount of, you know, some people within the Conservative Party who weren't happy with my views on Brexit or anything else. But actually, it came much more from people outside the Conservative Party who might have had past links or been involved in politics and everything else. Whereas I think what was so damaging for the Labour MPs like Luciana or like Jess Phillips or others is that these are people who were, for some period of time, often Labour Party members. And I think to be attacked by your own side, you accept a fair amount of abuse in politics, you're going to get that. That's, you know, that goes with the territory. There's no point standing, you're not going to get, and actually you're perfectly aware, you're going to stand on a doorstep, you're going to talk to people who are going to have a different view for you. Some want to debate, some will say thanks very much, I'm cooking tea with my children, you know, go away. But I think it's debilitating frustrating when it's your own party. And don't forget, again, a lot of people who are politicians, particularly the Labour Party, they've often, like me, grown up in the party. And so again, I think to see your own side so deeply divided, and with the anti-Semitism in particular for people like Luciana, well, it was very debilitating and very draining, I think, on politics generally. And what it did was it stopped the Labour Party being a proper opposition to government, which is what our democracy needs.
It's certainly the case that these intra-party divides seem to be much more bitter. I mean, Labour Party people hate each other much more than they hate the Tory MPs sometimes.
Sometimes.
Well, because then you're dealing, aren't you, with someone who you know you disagree with, and then there's a civility.
That's exactly right.
But you can pile into your colleagues, especially your members or other members, with sort of impunity.
Yeah. Well, you know how to needle them, because you are often you might not agree with a number of things, but you will have come. You might be sitting in the same local party meetings. You're at the same party conferences and all the rest of it. You know, again, go back to tribalism and the reason a lot of people join political parties is because you're surrounded by people who think broadly like you. Every political party, putting aside the divisions of the Labour Party of recent years or Brexit, political parties tend to be quite, you know, broad church, and you assemble groups of people. And so you expect that, you know, I'm not going to sit in my local party meeting in Loughborough and agree with every other party member on every issue. And a manifesto is cobbled together from different rings of the party, as it were, and different views. But broadly, you're in the same space. And I think what people found again was they turned up at local constituency Labour Party meetings and they were literally fighting for their political life or political career. Having been bloody good MPs, that was damaging.
And they're not only other people you're divided with within your party, but they're people who were adjacent to your party who've come back in, whether it be from the Brexit Party or from Left Unity, and they've come in a kind of unfavourable takeover, a hostile takeover, which is even harder to take.
Absolutely.
I mean, I thought it was very interesting you talked about these parties as kind of like supporting sports teams, like unfortunately supporting Arsenal in my case, for my sins. But which is, I think, one of the ways I was seeing it was like a Star Trek convention. It's like a cult convention. It's something that you have markers and cultural identifiers in common. And I wondered about why we've become so divided, because I've certainly got things I'd point to, but why have we become so balkanized like this? I mean, literally a mob has just invaded the capital of the United States. We're not as divided as Americans, but we could get there one day. So why is this pathology emerging?
I think that obviously economic factors are crucial. Economic decline is a necessary condition for all of this. I think, though, that there are wider factors that have led to polarization, though, also. Well, we can talk about social media a bit later. We're all active on that. I think, though, there's been a wider process of polarization. If you were talking about geography a bit earlier, over the last few decades, you've had the rise of these very urban, very young liberal cities like Cardiff, Manchester, Sheffield, London, and they, of course, they collect or they congregate a certain type of person, the young social cultural professionals / students. And at the same time, you have post-industrial areas like the Welsh Valleys or places in the north of England, which are very different. And if people don't really talk to each other, it's very difficult to find common ground. I think as well, it's very interesting to look at the institutional, at what's happening to some of our institutions. Universities, for example, are very interesting. Because at the moment, a primary cleavage in politics is education. Education predicts things like support for remaining in the EU or liberal immigration policies. Now, the problem is that for obvious reasons, universities collect educated people. And it means that you have a concentration of people with a particular political view. And I don't think it's healthy for democracy to have such a situation. So that's not a positive development. Mixing with other people does something very, very important. There was a very good book written a few years ago by the American sociologist Arlie Hochschild, Strangers in Their Own Land, where she did spend time with Trump supporters. Now, she certainly didn't come out and vote for Trump subsequently, but she at least saw, you know, who these people were and what why they thought like they did and understood them. And I think that always happens when you meet someone, whether it's from a right-wing movement you dislike or a left-wing movement you dislike, when you meet the actual people, the crude stereotypes disintegrate and you're able to actually engage with them. I think that's the case.
If we take universities as a case study, which of course we two know about, is there a way of bridging that? Because that seems to me to be a case study of, could social democracy, therefore, and the technique you recommend, which is walk a mile in someone else's shoes, can academics and students somehow bridge across to some of the communities that they live in? How could your technique help these Labour, Lib Dem, Green voting people to break out of their tiny geographical core where they're all packed so high?
I think that it's all, you know, I try writing about suggestions in the book. It's always tough to do that, but because I, like most academics, I primarily see things in structural terms. I see the influence of structures everywhere. So it is tough to talk about how to break out of echo chambers. I think what with the people in university, social cultural professions, I think such people tend to have left-wing economic views, but is it often those views aren't quite as similar to the views of low-income voters as you would suppose, because low-income voters tend to support things like higher benefits and higher minimum wage, with more affluent progressives, it tends to be about things like active labour market policies and tuition fees and public sector pay and things that it's very difficult to bridge the divide. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try, but of course it's difficult.
And this latter point, of course, as you point out in the book, helps to explain the Corbyn programme in both 2017 and 2019, which would have been fantastic for people like you and me, but would certainly not have helped as much people on very low incomes or the working poor.
Yes, yeah. With the Labour manifesto of 2017, it's got a sort of a legendary status, and I'm going to kind of commit blasphemy now. But one can argue that it was the least redistributive Labour manifesto ever. Institute for Fiscal Studies analysis clearly shows that it distributed money to middle-income deciles. Torsten Bell is very good on this. Whereas previous Labour manifestos had concentrated on low-income issues like benefits, like the minimum wage and services which are used by low-income deciles. So yes, it's a problem.
One example of this is payments to WASPI women in the 2019, which wasn't even into the public domain until the actual campaign. And then it turns out that at very low incomes, that would have been taxed away in pension credit.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, or with public sector pay, it amazes people when you say, "Well, actually, this isn't quite the progressive issue you think it is." But
this is heresy. Well, RIP your mentions is all I can say after that set of heresy. But Nikki, the Conservatives have moved to a more interventionist, a more red Tory position than even David Cameron wanted to. Yeah. So basically, I think in good times, Boris Johnson would just go around the country handing out billions, partly because he wishes to be liked. It's a personality trait, I think. But are there problems with that in terms of some of your voters who will become more and more disillusioned with basically the Tories pitching up in Leeds and blowing taxpayers' money on a tram system or whatever it is?
Well, I mean, yes, you only have to look at the front page of the Telegraph around sort of, I guess, November, well, when we thought there might be something approaching some kind of mini budget in the autumn, you know, when we before the second wave of the virus really took off and people begin to say, well, how are we going to start repairing the holes in the public finances? And there started to be sort of speculation about tax rises, particularly relating to capital gains tax. And the Telegraph and others completely got on their high horse immediately and said, no, we can't do that. And we can't tax, income tax. We can't put income tax up and everything else, can't tax assets. So the answer is, of course, there will be for some voters, some Conservative MPs. But equally, I think they also understand that part of the reason, and the Prime Minister would have been in normal times very clear, that the reason we won some of the seats in 2019, partly Brexit, but also partly kind of understanding they felt very forgotten, taken for granted, and therefore he was going to come in and, you know, help them to invest in infrastructure or education or whatever it might be that was identified by the local members of parliament. Of course, we're now in a very different political situation, and when normal politics is going to be resumed and what it will look like, well, it's possible to see, it's difficult to know when it might happen.
The Tories are going to be in a bind because they're going to need a huge amount of cash. And for instance, although this was speaking once again against my own interests, number one thing to get rid of would be higher rate tax relief on pensions.
And inevitably there'll be outrage and opposition and everything else. I mean, I think what you'll probably see in terms of the economy is a very long, I mean, as long as interest rates stay low, I think what you won't see, and the Prime Minister is absolutely clear about this, no return to what was called austerity, and George Osborne would have called something else, and we're not going back. That it'll take a long time to repair the public finances. We're not going to try and do it by the time of the next general election, or try to show, I think, a balanced budget by the mid-2020s, because that clearly is going to take much longer. So you're right, that is a real change from the economic policy of 2010, when Cameron and Osborne were there in the Treasury. Can I just pick up on a couple of things that Tom?
Of course.
The thing about tribalism, why is it? I mean, I think, and Tom touched on it, I think there was a, when people, don't forget, real wages didn't go up for 10 years. And I think the longer that goes on, and you guys study politics in a way that I haven't done, but economists and academics will say that the longer that goes on, the more likely you are to have people starting to move to the further reaches of the political system, if I can put it like that. I was going to say extremes, but I don't think we're talking about extremes necessarily here. I think we're just talking about people who promise, like Trump, we're going to cut through this and get things done. And I think there's also frustration amongst people. They're constantly told, well, we can't do it because of this, we can't do it because of that, that's not it. And so I think people just got really frustrated and then look around for somebody who doesn't tell you how they're going to do it, just says that, promises they are, without having any answers. And I think that's where that appeal to those kind of politicians very much comes in. And there was some fascinating evidence. I'm on the House of Lords COVID-19 committee, and just yesterday we were talking about the change in the last year, the digital living online, what that's doing to all of us and everything else. And the point about belonging and social contact, actually what they were saying was, of course, for many of us, we're doing these kinds of events or speaking to friends, and we're missing even the basic meeting of people with different lifestyles and views from us. The people you see on the bus, the people you see on the tube, the person you buy your coffee from in the morning, the person you stand next to in the supermarket queue. None of that. We're not doing that at the moment because of the pandemic. And in terms of, I mean, actually, politics is one of the best ways, active campaigning politics, of seeing people who live very different lifestyles from yourself. And I remember when I was working in law in the city, one of the partners saying to me, he said, you've got a much better insight. This is after I've been a candidate in Islington, which again is one of your classic seats where you've got incredibly wealthy areas. And, some really, one of the biggest council estates in Europe. I think it was one of the ones that was opened by Harold Wilson. People living literally cheek by jowl. And he said, you will have a much better insight now into how people are living lives than we ever would sitting here in a city law firm. And that's completely right. So the more you can encourage people to go and do something that gets them to see different people with different lifestyles, that begins the process of people understanding. I may not change my views, but I understand, exactly as Tom said, why people are motivated to vote or to support or to think in the way that they do.
So one of the economic factors here, Tom, is the lack of, there's one, lack of progress, economic progress that people have felt, most people in the UK have felt for absolutely decades since the Second World War. And there's also this lack of contact that you were talking about, day-to-day contact with other people. One example, something I know a lot about, is of course Northern Ireland, where you don't meet people necessarily from the so-called other community.
Of course. I think on the MP point that Nikki made, the Isabel Hardman, yeah, that book is a very nice one, actually. It shows, actually, that politicians can be very in touch because they do the surgeries. The surgeries are a very good way of meeting people and talking about it. With tribalism, I think that there are lots of ways we've got to try and get around it, yeah.
Isn't the fact that we have more specialisation and segmentation in the economy quite interesting? Because what's brilliant about this discussion is we're not talking about Twitter. We're not talking about, it's all social media, which, Tom, you've already said, can be something that gets in the way of understanding. But social classes go to quite different supermarkets, which in the 1960s, there was, certainly as a historian, you might have had a more similar experience going to smaller stores. Mm-hmm. If you look at different types of supermarket, they've got rather different types of people going to them. And that's one example of things we're consuming differently. Mm-hmm. So what I mean is we don't have a single narrative. So we don't all watch Morecambe and Wise or whatever it is. Do you think there's something cultural about that, about the way in which the economy is delivering much more narrow cast experiences?
Yeah, I think it's a wide social problem. As I was saying earlier, geographical factors are really leading to the polarisation. The different supermarkets are in the different cities and whatever. On the economy, the literature actually shows that's not as much of a cause of support for populism as you would think. Of course, it's an important cause of support for populism, but also cultural factors are very important as well. So you've got to think about culture, and of course big cities and the universities and other things. It does create cultural sort of echo chambers. I think maybe we should talk about social media actually because it's so different.
Oh, okay. No, we will.
We've avoided it for long enough.
I did want to make one point before that, which is that I think that we talk a lot about the university towns and urban areas, which light up a lot in our imagination. But the culture of deep England in towns is an absolutely fascinating and rich one, which one of the things going on here is a feeling of being patronised by London.
Yeah.
Is a feeling, yeah. Basically, people are looking down their noses at you. And you write about this very well in the book. A set of people whose cultural values, if you really push to it, you'll probably lean over towards, actually, if you really have to choose in a binary way. But you don't like someone telling you what they should be, telling you what they should think.
Yeah, I think that progressives are quite bad at understanding cultural conservatism among lower class people in the West. A very interesting thing is that progressives are very good at understanding cultural conservatism in developing countries. In that context, they see that it reflects psychological, cultural, socioeconomic factors. Views are very difficult to change if you're born in such an environment. It's quite a sophisticated interpretation. So yes, I think that it's a shame that some progressives, not all, are unable to emphasise a bit better with lower class cultural conservatives. I'd say that if you're a lower class voter in Stoke, and you're culturally conservative or the values, I think that a key finding in the literature is that cultural values are functional. They fulfill certain function. And not saying I necessarily agree with many of them or all of them, but it may be that you want more stability, you want greater certainty. So I would say they are legitimate.
Well, I was going to say something that Nikki said earlier. It may be that if you're a small C conservative or even a big C conservative, you may see the end, perhaps, of social change as being just as desirable, but you may wish, for instance, to go more slowly towards it. You may in fact believe as an idealistic value that slower change is more likely to be change that sticks. For instance, something conservatives have always said, social conservatives like you're talking about.
Yes, of course. And that sounds very much like social democracy as well, actually. We've had the rise, particularly in Britain, but also a bit in Western Europe. We've had the rise, I think, of hyper-liberals, people who are very assertive about their cultural liberalism. You saw that with pockets of the Remain movement. I think there's a need just to slow down a bit and see there's a need to understand things are going too fast for some people. If you destabilize in institutions, yes, as you've said, it might not be likely to be there for the long term. It's better to work slowly but surely and achieve change in a slower fashion.
So let's come on to social media then, and lastly in our sort of very wide ranging discussion, what's the role of social media in this hyper partisanship then? Because we've just seen Parler, I think that's how you pronounce it, this social media tool of the Trumpites used to actually invade the Congress building, and we can map the movement of very radical right wing elements across this event that we historians are going to be writing about, no doubt, for decades to come. So clearly something was going on the Trump right that was radicalizing people inside an echo chamber. But what's going on more generally when we look at softer versions of that, like basically Corbynism on social media or Brexitism on Twitter?
Well, I mean, undoubtedly, social media has, it's introduced a whole new element into politics. So when I first started out, campaigning was pretty traditional. It was very much about face-to-face contact with voters, perhaps the odd sort of town hall meeting style thing, or you invited, you've got somebody in a row to invite their neighbours round to meet the candidate type thing. And then, of course, Facebook. I think I opened my Twitter account in 2009. And, then it was a new medium and people were testing it out. I mean, look, there's the traditional argument about the echo chamber. It's very easy on all these things just to talk to people or follow people that, you think are like you or you agree with. And I think with the demise of people reading newspapers all the way through necessarily, rather than just looking at other people's links that they've posted, it is good to read something which challenges your view. And I'm asked by sixth formers or schools, and I go and speak to them about what they should do. I mean, reading a couple of good newspapers every day is the best way really to get a sense of what people are saying, and also what you think about it. My worry, and I gave it into an interview on Today programme this morning about, Trump having been taken off Twitter, I think long overdue, but they've accepted they're now publishers, not platforms. My only worry, and it goes back a little bit to what Tom was saying about the progressive, the liberals, and how they treated people with the views they disagree with, is you've got to avoid making people martyrs. Immediately this morning, I'd said, yes, actually, it's completely right that Twitter has taken Trump off and everything else. There are enough people ready and willing to jump straight in and say, it's an outrage. Obviously, who should be regulating our political views? We've now got to go to these other platforms and everything else. So I think there is a debate to be had there about, there obviously is a line. If you're inciting violence, that has to be a line that is too far, being crossed, needs to be dealt with. But equally, if you push people more and more underground, it's the same with the closed Facebook sites, then actually I think potentially enable people to be radicalized in some senses, just by being surrounded by people who are grooming them effectively. And you end up potentially with the consequences like last week.
Tom, do you think this is accelerant? Does this just...
I think, that's a very good description, actually. It's an accelerant. You'd have a difficult time arguing that social media is the cause of today's polarisation. Polarisation has taken place at different times over the centuries. And I'm very interested in Poland, and I'd say that social media has got a lower penetration there, actually. But that's still a dreadfully polarised society, can't think right now, but I'd imagine there are studies that shows that social media's influence isn't quite as big as is commonly emphasised. But of course, it's an accelerant. It's been very interesting, actually, to witness the social media activity in the Labour Party over the last year, because some of the...
That's one word for it.
Yeah, some of the... There have been new MPs who've come in and have become social media stars, getting all of these likes. But I think they are having zero influence at the top of the party, because, you notice the people who are closer to the leadership are much quieter. They're not attracting this kind of attention. And I don't think that the Labour leadership cares about Twitter, which is, well, I'm sure they care about it, but it's certainly weighed down. They are a list of priorities for good reason.
The voters in the Red Wall seats, I doubt very much. There will, of course, be Twitter users there, but they are, if you're going to reach out to those voters, you're not going to do it via Twitter. You might actually do it via Facebook. And I always found that there was a much greater penetration of Facebook amongst sort of the voters I needed to appeal to than Twitter. Twitter is very much for those of us who are, you know, political anoraks, journalists. You know, I never sent out a press release after about 2015, because all I did was put it on Twitter and I knew immediately that the press were going to pick something up. So the voters that Labour Party used to appeal to, many of them, I can see why Tom's saying that Twitter's not their thing, because they're not on Twitter.
Well, indeed, the Biden campaign has just said, get off Twitter. This is our first rule. And it's my first rule these days as well, which is a good rule. Mm. But we know this is the case as well. With the 2017 election, quite a lot of social media moved voters from Conservative, from Theresa May, towards Labour in the campaign over, for instance, fox hunting, ivory trade, these issues that maybe politicians didn't see as front and centre, but had very, very impactful videos about them. You know, I'd probably say those two things probably cost Theresa May her majority on their own, because she was so close to an overall majority, as it was just a few thousand votes.
Do you think so? Or do you think it was just, you know, not taking part in debates and all that sort of thing? I think in a way, what Tom's talking about earlier on, those culturally conservative voters, whether it's Jeremy Corbyn not watching the Queen on Christmas Day, or Theresa May not taking part in debate, or David Cameron riding with a bicycle when the box goes in a car, it's just something like that that just captures a person. And very hard to row back from that once you've been captured by that thing.
Yeah, it's just to say that social media can also detach people from their party rather than entrenching them, because they can now see.
Yes, that's true. It causes you to question, am I right to be supporting or potentially voting for these people?
One example would be socially liberal referendum victories in the Republic of Ireland, where it was very much promoted that you should talk to your grandma about gay marriage and about these issues and persuade rather than... So it can be a great persuasive tool.
It was meant to be. I mean, I think Jack Dorsey set it up. I mean, you know, if you believe what he says, he set it up in order to do exactly that, to get things out there, persuade, facilitate conversation. And you can still do that to a certain extent. I'm beginning to find, having taken a step back from frontline political life, but it's still people do rush to judgment more often than not. And that's how they get picked up. And then you create those Twitter storms.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Tom, do you want to just sum up what you've taken from this and what you've taken from writing the book before we finish?
I think with the book, as I was saying, I tried to use my academic experience, in this case, acquaintance with institutional theory, to write something that shed new light on politics. And I think what I've taken from the discussion tonight is there's tremendous interest in this. On the other hand, look, you have lots of people who say, okay, politics is very tribal, but that's good. You know, people want to get involved and they want to dispute what's happening. And I guess you can say that, because if politics is all very consensual and cosy, there's an allegation that it's a sort of an inside game or whatever. So you've got to strike a balance. I hope, so I hope I start a conversation with the book anyway.
Well, I suppose it falls to me to say thank you to everyone for coming. Thank you to Tom and Nikki and Richard. I really, really enjoyed that. And thank you, Tom, for asking me to chair tonight. What I took from this was that there's a huge amount to say, and we could go on and on, or at least we could. Yes, we could. And we hope that we will all meet physically one day as well in future times when things look much better. Because what I would take from this discussion, and also what I would take from the book, is that I think I have much more hope than I have kind of despair about these issues, because British people are not particularly divided by the standards of what we've just seen in the United States. They're not particularly divided about reactions to COVID. If we look at polling, they're not particularly divided on if we are going to leave the European Union, what some of the deal might look like. They're not particularly divided on most social issues, in fact. They have much, to coin a phrase, there's much more that unites us than divides us. And I think that's very important. And that's what's partly come out of tonight. So thank you all so much for coming. I hope that we've all been useful. And I hope we've all been a little bit entertaining. And I hope we'll see you again at another one of these Cardiff University events. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Golay, a Cardiff University podcast. Subscribe in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from to have the next episode download automatically.